Hey now, we are getting over, and I am the Silver King, Adam Silverstein, here to lead you through these hard times. With episode 567 of your favorite professional wrestling podcast. That's right, Getting Over is back once again, and it is Thursday, so you know exactly what that means. We are here to break down everything that happened over the last week across NXT and AEW. Over in NXT, they are undoubtedly gearing up for Stand and Deliver, the premium live event attached, of course, to WWE WrestleMania 40. While over in AEW, they had a big special AEW Big Business Edition of Dynamite on Wednesday. As always here on Getting Over, we have an absolute ton to discuss across this program, so let's not waste any more time. Allow me to remind you straight off the top that the Getting Over Wrestling Podcast
is all about Defy.
So head on over to Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Leave a five-star rating on Apple. Take a little extra time. Leave a five-star written review. If you do, we will read it live right here on the show. Don't forget to give us a follow over on Twitter at Getting Overcast for episode drops, news, analysis, highlights, all of that good stuff. You can also send in questions and comments for the show, whether via regular tweet or direct message, all of that on Twitter at Getting Overcast. And one other avenue for you to contact us if you so choose, that's via email, gettingoverpod@gmail.com. Please also remember,
I happen to love the number 5.
And I hope you do as well, because for $5 a month or $50 for the entire year, you can become an official Getting Overhead. Just visit buymeacoffee.com/gettingover. Sign up. You will get bonus audio, the fastest 5 minutes in professional wrestling, instant recaps and reactions to Raw, NXT, Dynamite, and SmackDown, along with exclusive news posts every single Friday. Again, all of that available, $5 a month, $50 for the entire year. buymeacoffee.com/gettingover. Now, obviously, the debut of Mercedes Moné in AEW is the big topic on today's show, but there's so much that happened in AEW over the last week. We are, of course, going to save that for the second half of the program. We're going to kick things off with NXT. As always, there are timestamps in the episode description. So if you want to hop around, go back and forth, you only want to listen about one brand or the other, you can do that. But as always, I hope you listen to the entire show. So before we get into the full analysis of NXT, two quick news items. First, CM Punk was at the WWE Performance Center again this week, and he was also in attendance for NXT. He has been there frequently since signing with WWE and frequently since getting injured. It is fair to make the assumption, I don't have this as direct news, that he's doing some rehabilitation and work over there. But beyond that, he continues to help mentor young talent, which is something that he's always been interested in ever since returning to wrestling, not in WWE, but in AEW a couple of years ago. There was also a social media video posted of Wes Lee stepping back into a wrestling ring for the first time since having surgery on his back about 3 months ago. Now, he's supposed to be out for a year, and all we saw was him literally stepping between the ropes. So I don't think this is a huge indication of anything. He's not coming back soon, certainly not by Stand and Deliver weekend or anything like that. But the fact that he's moving around, the fact that he felt comfortable to climb in like that, that is obviously a massive positive. Now let's get into NXT itself from Tuesday night. Trick Williams closed the show with the mic saying he felt betrayed by Carmelo Hayes, whose back he's had like a brother over the last 2 years. Trick said he didn't believe the haters or even John Cena, who told him to watch his back with Melo. But his boy has been lying to him about everything, attacking him, having his back, even being his brother. Trick challenged Melo for a match at Stand and Deliver when Metaphor randomly interrupted. Williams twice told Noam Dar, mind your business, stay down. But Dar persisted, saying he wanted to steal his hype and his momentum. Trick called out Lash Legend for giving him, let's call them F me eyes. And Noam got in the ring saying he wanted to fight next week. Williams got his licks on Dar and Oro Mensa before grabbing Lash and dipping her in his arms. She grabbed her chest in surprise, then grabbed his face and started making out with him right in the middle of the ring as she swooned in his arms to end the show. I don't even know what to say about this. Everything Trick said in his promo was spot on, so this was hitting. Then Metaphor randomly comes out for no real reason. And I'm like, what the hell? This is completely going off the rails. And then seconds later, Trick is there making out with Lash and everyone is going absolutely wild for it, appropriately so. Talk about a power couple. And they're seemingly dating in real life. So my Lord, Trick is really talking that talk, as he says so often. Dude comes out with Booker T hyping him up. He challenges his former best friend for a potential PLE main event on WrestleMania weekend. He kicks the shit out of two guys, and then he makes Lash swoon and starts kissing her. There may be no ceiling for this guy at this point. He's the total package, and it was as obvious as ever here that they are going all the way with Trick Williams. There's only three NXTs left before Stand and Deliver, so we really do need to get to that direct Trick mellow build starting next week through the end of the month, but there is still enough time. And my only other thought here is the CW is absolutely going to love this when it goes over to its air in October. I would be remiss if I did not point out there was a social media segment posted after NXT that was quite entertaining. I only play these on the show if I feel they're necessary. And I do feel like this one's necessary just because it's so much fun. The concept at the beginning here is Lash Legend running into the training room, grabbing her chest, all flushed and emotional, not exactly knowing what to do.
Medical! Hey,
are you okay?
Are you okay?
How are you, huh?
Are you okay?
Yes.
You
good?
Good?
I'm okay.
Okay.
I'm okay.
What was that?
What
was
that? Some people are wrong.
Your face trap must be on too tight, because what were you thinking?
Uh-huh. Hey, it's click before trek.
Hey, hey, okay. Listen. Yes. It's bros before.
Whoa! Stop.
I never speak here.
Let's check her. Get the lollipop. Okay. Okay. Lash, finish the sentence. Metaphor.
Above it all.
Yes, yeah. Above it all. Okay. Thank you. Okay,
you do the thing, do the thing.
We forgive you, okay? Bye to normal.
Medic!
You know, when Metaphor first debuted, I was like iffy about it. I'm like, I don't know if this is going to work. It seems kind of odd. And then all of a sudden it started hitting. And now it is just through the roof successful. This is one of the most entertaining groups right now, I would say, in professional wrestling. Segments like that, what we got, of course, on NXT on television are the reasons why. Let's go ahead. We'll talk about everything else that happened on NXT. Roxanne Perez was wearing all black in the ring, saying she's sick of playing by the rules. And what's been boiling inside of her over these last couple months was finally released in her attack on Lyra Valkyria last week. Perez referred to collapsing last year, saying it came from exhaustion because she was carrying the women's division on her back while having the best rookie year in history. Roxy said she's been busting her ass while everyone else was excited about Indy Hartwell winning in that ladder match. They were excited about Tiffany Stratton taking the title from her and Becky Lynch finally taking the NXT title from Tiffy. She was pissed that the fans chose Becky over her when they fought, especially because she's won all four crowns there are to win to this point in NXT. Roxy shit on Lola Vice as a dancing idiot. She criticized Lyra for overlooking her as a challenger and going after the tag team titles instead. And she explained that led to her breaking the rules and doing it her own way, whether she has the support or approval or neither from the fans. She invited Ava down to vacate the title and award it to her because she never lost it. Ava came down to kind of lay the law, but Tatum Paxley attacked out of the crowd only to get pulled away by referees. Roxy was really strong, almost surprisingly strong, in her first heel promo. It helped that she was speaking facts and making valid points. We always say the best heels are the ones that tell the truth, but just have it through their tinted vision. The problem? Well, the segment was about twice as long as it needed to be. So she was out there basically being forced to restate her perspective because there was nothing else left for her to say or explain. Now, that's not on her. That's on whoever timed and produced the segment. But Perez did her part. She got over as a heel. Her change in clothes and makeup played into the character adjustment. And while it's tough to initially buy into such a sweet person being a bad guy, this is obviously just the start of her in this gimmick. It was not that dissimilar from AJ Lee back in the day. And it really would not be a bad idea for Roxy to kind of adopt that same erratic gimmick at some point if it becomes appropriate. Probably the way that would become appropriate is if she does not win the title at Stand and Deliver. But given the way the NXT title looks like it's trending, and we'll talk about that in a moment, I think Roxy winning the women's championship has a great chance of happening. So let's go over and talk about the men's title. D'Angelo family commiserated over dinner, excited about the future. Tony D said his path is now clear. He put over Stacks for hitting the music at the right time last week. Then Tony explained that Trick Williams played along because he wanted revenge on Carmelo anyway. Ilya Dragunov approached the table in the restaurant with Tony excusing the rest of the family. They did a brief stare down. Then Ilya put over Tony for fulfilling his promise. He pointed out that Tony's being pulled in tons of different directions with all of his businesses trying to go after the NXT title. Meanwhile, the title is Ilya's lone focus. D'Angelo said he liked Dragunov when suddenly Stacks and Luca Crucifino dragged him away. Then I guess the owner of the restaurant or something comes up. He's wearing a pink Bay Hill polo shirt. For those who don't know, that's a golf course, a famous golf course in Orlando, random as hell. Then Ilya gets stuffed into the trunk of a Hyundai and the family drives off. Later, they release Dragunov from the trunk while they were on a bridge so D'Angelo could flex his power. But rather than feed him to the fishes, he just left him there to walk all the way back himself. Now, there's not too much to analyze here other than to say this was probably the best of these segments since all the way back in the Legado del Fantasma feud. But even so, and I say this, let me be very clear. As someone who literally drives a Hyundai himself, I'm trying to get a new car, but right now I still drive a Hyundai. The combination of the random dude in a pink golf course polo shirt and this mafia family that is supposed to have a ton of money stuffing a dude into the trunk of a Hyundai, which is their car because all of them were driving, it kind of hurt the legitimacy of this family as some high-powered group. You know what I mean? Like, at least put them in a Cadillac or a Buick or something like that. I'm still not overly enthused about this matchup. I will say this was better than expected overall. The part on the bridge, for me, stood out from the rest of it. LWO fought out the mud in a qualifier in this mini tag team tournament to determine number one contenders for the titles at Stand and Deliver. The heels attacked during the ring entrance with Brock Onyema, later hitting a one-arm superplex. Lucian Price had a couple botches, but he did sell his ass off in the match. Joaquin Wilde ran and jumped off Nima's back for a sky-high tope onto OTM outside before he got an assist from Cruz del Toro for a double jump springboard 450 and the win. Wilde is an absurd individual at this point. I know Ricochet's nickname is Highlight of the Night. Wilde actually represents that gimmick better, at least on NXT. Those two moves in the finishing sequence were outstanding. And while OTM is still insanely green, LWO carried them to a pretty damn fun match. The Good Brothers backstage said they've been winning titles and traveling the world before Hank and Tank were even born. They said their goal was to line them up and knock them down until they face the Wolf Dogs at Stand and Deliver. Hank and Tank were watching. They put themselves over as blue-collar brawlers and underdogs that were going to shock the world. They also had a new logo. The Wolf Dogs dapped them up as fellow football players, got them insanely hyped up for their match. It was fun stuff all around. Good to see some personality from Hank and Tank. It's clear the Good Brothers are going to ultimately be in this title match at Stand and Deliver. So really, they were just previewing next week's match. The North American Championship was on the line. Oba Femi defending against Brooks Jensen. Oba expressed confidence in the parking lot that led to Brooks shoving him. And then Josh Briggs breaking it up. Femi threatened both of them after that went down. Oba later called Brooks an ignorant boy who was about to get slaughtered. Dijak confronted Femi as he was wrapping up his promo, basically showing he would be the next challenger. Femi destroyed Jensen with Briggs watching backstage. He eventually made his way to the ring to kind of motivate his boy. Oba twice tossed Brooks with the one-arm slams. Then he hit two power bombs while laughing in Briggs' face, staring him down during the 1-2-3. It was a bit surprising that Jensen didn't get more in this match. I did not expect Femi to be this dominant, but it was also appropriate because of their respective gimmicks. I wasn't a fan of the new furry armbands that Oba was wearing. They really distracted from his immense build. It was almost like they tried to lean into some of the Black Panther regalia on him, and I just didn't really think it fit his character, which for me is more of like Nigerian warlord than it is kind of Black Panther type of comic book movie brawler type of dude. And look, Femi still got a long way to go in the ring. He's still massively green, but this accomplished what it needed to, and I'm excited to see what Femi can do against Briggs and or Dijak going forward. I could definitely see that being a triple threat match at Stand and Deliver. Ridge Holland fought Sean Spears. Ridge received a FaceTime from his wife and daughter while he was stretching before the match. Spears smacked him across the face to basically force him to let it out. And then he yelled while he was on Holland's shoulder as Ridge refused to drive him into the post outside. so Spears drove him into the post instead. Holland eventually snapped, like, kind of. He got more aggressive with Spears outside the ring. He pulled apart the steel steps, cleared off the announce table. He screamed that Spears wanted this. Then he chokeslammed him off the stairs through the table. They were outside the ring for 20, 25 seconds, so this should have been a double countout, but the referee just never counted. So Ridge brought a chair inside the ring, only for the referee to pull it out of his arms. Spears countered Northern Grit with a C4 into the corner while the chair was laying on the canvas, and he got the win. It was an inventive finish, certainly a unique match in terms of what they were trying to accomplish. Spears did get the shit kicked out of him. He had marks all over his back, and I guess Holland and kayfabe found the rage that Spears wanted him to find, but it just felt like the match never got out of the second gear. It was slow, plodding, really mediocre at best. I'm still not into the storyline. I don't know how it's going to resolve itself. And while I know some people are excited that Spears is back, I'm not against it. Like I said, he's a good hand, and it's worthwhile for him to be in NXT. This storyline as the first one for him, it's just really not doing it for me at all. Andre Chase and Thea Hale made amends backstage. Duke Hudson asked who was partnering with her, only for Hale to show an Instagram of JC Jane and Jasmine Nix chilling together without her. Thea tried to act like she wasn't upset because she has other friends, and Kalani Jordan walked in to team up with her for the match. It was kind of nice to see the old original Chase U all back together in the segment, kind of like a good old days type of thing. Kalani was shown having been attacked backstage before the match. That left Thea without a partner. She ran to the ring, manically screaming at the heels. Seconds after the bell rang, Fallon Henley ran out, as expected, to team with her. So we got Thea and Fallon against Kiana James and Izzy Dame. JC and Jasmine entered in the faces corner a few minutes into the match. Thea got the hot tag and randomly hit a world strongest slam, plus a springing senton. Kiana caught her with a perfect spinebuster, but escaped a Kimura lock by dumping Thea outside the ring. JC saved Fallon from a kick, but that kick ended up nailing Thea in the face, and then she took bankrupt inside for the heel victory. I'll repeat once again, and I'm going to keep saying it until it stops. Bankrupt is not even one-tenth the finisher that the 401k was for James. I have no clue why they switched it. It is so shitty. The concept of Henley not being Hale's partner initially, it was so nonsensical because they've been aligned together on TV for like 2 weeks coming into this. After this was over, Hale cried on the mic because she finally thought she had found a role model, a best friend. She said she changed herself for Jane, only for JC to be pretending the entire time. Instead, Thea called JC out for becoming even more rotten during their time together, saying she didn't want to be anything like her, and she may not be cool enough for her, but the old Thea Hale is back. Then she just ran around the ring like a Tasmanian devil. The heels jumped through the ropes. Jane called her ungrateful, and the segment ended. Thea got a great reaction for turning against JC, but I wish they had paid it off with like her running around and then Thez pressing her and attacking her, and then Nix saves Jane from the attack or something like that. It just kind of ended with a thud because all she was doing was running around the ring in a circle. It would have been a far stronger conclusion than what they did otherwise, but it was still a good moment for her character, and Thea is massively over with the fans. Riley Osborne was celebrating Thea finding herself backstage when No Quarter Catch crew came in, saying that Hale was at her best when she was actually working with them. That was a good bit of continuity. I completely forgot about that. The heels threatened him when Nathan Frazier and Axiom stood alongside to get his back. Both prior Heritage Cup champions, they were confident that Osborne could take the cup from No Quarter Catch crew. But the crew said the goal was to walk out of stand and deliver with the cup and the tag team titles. It's always fun when they do like the tongue-in-cheek gimmick of Axiom pretending A-Kid is someone completely different. This was a fine segment overall. Gigi Dolin fought Ariana Grace. Gigi got most of the offense. Ariana tried to put her tiara on Dolan's head, but when the referee took it away, Grace mule-kicked her behind his back. So Dolin gave her a straight-up low blow right in front of the referee, and that led to a disqualification. I cannot ever remember seeing a woman get disqualified because she low-blowed another woman. Ah! I mean, technically, at least in MMA rules, low blows are illegal no matter whether it's a men's or women's fight. The only difference is men are required to wear cups in MMA, and women, of course, are not. So I guess if wrestling rules are universal in the same way, this completely works in kayfabe. I've just never seen something like this. And that's one thing that NXT is good for, showing us things that we've just never seen before, or at least have not seen in a long time. But this fit into what they're trying to do with Ariana. And it's certainly the more fun outcome, because the stipulation is that Gigi now needs to become a lady. She has to basically go to finishing school or whatever. Plus, if you go back and watch a highlight of this, the face that Ariana makes selling the low blow, it is an all-timer. Her lips are like pursed. Her eyes are bugging out. It is downright hysterical. She is such a great character actor. You can tell she gets it from her father, Santino Marella, for anyone who didn't know or didn't remember. She is just so much fun. Sol Ruka was excited to be back while speaking with Carmen Petrovic backstage. Lola came in talking shit, basically at Carmen, with Sol separating them. Brinley Reese then flipped into the room, all excited and energetic, only get dragged away by Malik Blade and Idris Enofe. It was just a world-building segment, but everyone did well. And lastly, Robert Stone fought Lexus King. Stone did hit a crossbody off the top rope, but King quickly leveled him and hit the coronation for the relative squash win. Wagner made the save, Von Wagner that is, as King was going to attack more, and he ultimately carried Stone off. You guys know what I feel here. It's just a whole lot of absolute nothing.
Market zero!
So that wraps up NXT this week. And, you know, I did note this on Twitter. We don't talk about ratings too much on the show, but NXT's ratings since the start of 2024, they've just been on a continuous downward trajectory. I don't want to call it spiral because it's not spiraling, but it's a continuous downward trajectory. And like I said, the brand is just losing momentum since the start of the year. I don't understand why the strategy changed. I get that technically there are some main roster names on the show. You have Baron Corbin, obviously. You have the Good Brothers, LWO, the tag team version, shows up occasionally. I do still believe the original plan was for Shotzi to beat Lyra Valkyrie. I don't know that to be fact. I just believe that was the plan, and she was probably going to take that title into Stand and Deliver. But these are mid to low card names. These are not people that are going to bring ratings to the show. And NXT was having so much success using some of those upper mid card to main event names on their program. It's WrestleMania season. Not everyone on the main roster has something to do. And it's just confusing to me that they have not leaned more into that. Now, I will give them credit because they're cross promoting. I saw a lot of promotion for NXT on Raw Monday night. That's a huge positive. But most of that promotion was just bottom third graphics. It wasn't like last year where you had the whole deal with Johnny Gargano and Grayson Waller, and previously, not for Stand and Deliver, they did angles with Dolph Ziggler and Bron Breakker and all these other people kind of mixing in with Raw just to kind of give a little bit of excitement to the show. Right now, it kind of feels to me they got the CW deal. They're like, all right, let's pack it in and wait until October. We'll put our best foot forward. And I'm not saying that the show is not entertaining anymore. This was a huge step up in terms of entertainment value from the last couple of weeks. I thought this was a very successful NXT. But in terms of drawing people to your brand, getting people to watch your show, they're just not really popping right now. And it's strange because the talent hasn't changed that much, but it's the effort, it's the direction, and it's some of that tie to the main roster that is lacking. They need to figure out a way to kind of get that going again. So hopefully, just because it is a quality show, NXT does pick up on the road to Stand and Deliver WrestleMania weekend. But yeah, they were under 600,000 viewers. The demo was kind of the same, which is fine. But they just got to figure something out because let's not forget, they were approaching 800,000 viewers earlier this year. There was one or maybe 2 weeks where they almost beat Dynamite in the ratings. And I don't mean beat because they were not head-to-head, and they've made that very clear. But just simple viewership numbers and demo numbers, they were nearly higher than AEW for like 1 or 2 weeks to start 2024, and now they're nowhere close. So they just got to figure it out. But it's a warning because if they keep going down this path, I don't know what kind of depths the ratings are going to fall to. So there you go. So that wraps up NXT. That allows us, of course, to move over to AEW. And before we get into big business, the Mercedes Moné debut and everything else that happened in the show this week, of course, we need to give our evaluation of AEW booking matches that do or do not have storyline relevance. There was a slight improvement this week. That's not surprising because Big Business was booked as a special show and Dynamite therefore carried most of the water for this metric. Ultimately, I saw 6 of 16 matches that were booked with legitimate reason. So we're around 38%, which again is up from the last 2 weeks. But again, nowhere near the goal, which should be basically double that, 2/3. Rampage was again a worthless show. Collision did have a couple good moments and some story relevant matches. But Dynamite was once again immensely strong. The first 75 minutes of Big Business were the best AEW television of the week, as they should have been. There was a big lull in hour two, but the main event picked it up. All in all, a strong special show. And based on the card, it looks like there's another one coming next week, another big show coming next week. And that's primarily because they're going to be going against the first four, the start of the NCAA tournament on TBS sister station, True TV. We will discuss that next week. So now let's move to discussing everything that happened on TV this week in AEW. And really the big business of it all started with Big Business on Wednesday night, a special edition of AEW Dynamite. So the show began with a cold open, Renee Paquette running down the card as a Maybach pulled into the arena with the door opening and we couldn't see anything after that. After more card rundown, Mercedes Moné made her debut with an entrance theme that was basically created to make fans chant CEO for her, which they did immediately as she strutted around and danced in the ring. She got emotional and said, "I'm home," met by welcome home chants. Mercedes thanked the fans for having her back, and she promised to create magic, saying all of it means so much to her. Mercedes got her Eddie Guerrero name drop in, saying she led a women's evolution and became the first to main event a pay-per-view. Then she got down to business, saying she needs and wants to be in AEW so she can create a global revolution. Now, obviously, a global revolution, AEW being the only company for that, tough to buy into that given what WWE is and what they've already done with the women's division. But to start a revolution, that is fair enough to say, I guess. Then she announced the regular planned women's match was main eventing the show. She tore off her jacket to reveal her gear, and then she danced some more. Now, at some point during these last 2 years, Mercedes must have figured out how to cut a promo without stumbling, because this was one of the best of her career, if not her best, just from a confidence and delivery standpoint. There is not much content to analyze. She did mention Willow Nightingale, but she didn't set forth a challenge or provide any concrete details about joining AEW. What I liked most was, look, we got a former WWE superstar debuting in AEW with nary a word about her former company. Everyone knew where she was from, but unlike others that preceded her, she didn't make it about that place being bad and needing to leave there to succeed. Mercedes had a reason to talk some shit, and yet she didn't. Instead, the focus was on her in AEW, which is where it should be. She looked great. The general part of her theme, which strangely sampled Symphony No. 9, very much a Gunther thing, but done in a pop music way, was okay. It doesn't really fit her at all. And everyone associates that with Gunther and Imperium. So I don't understand why out of every song that could have been sampled, they chose that one. It doesn't even fit with the CEO gimmick. But the worst part of the theme is the CEO chanting aspect of it. It very much reminded me when WCW got cold and they had to start inserting Goldberg chants into his music because the crowd just didn't do it on their own. That's not needed here. Now, if this was just for the debut, so fans knew when and how to chant it, they got the cadence, cool. But if I have to hear those chants being piped in as part of the music every single time it plays through the PA, that is going to be annoying as hell. Just let it be natural. AEW fans are going to chant for her. There is no need for it to be part of the theme. But even without those chants, the entrance music is rough, especially given what she's had in the past in WWE. But even in any NJPW, in New Japan, that theme was way better than what we got here. This brings me to my other point. And I said this upon her debut in New Japan. CEO is an awful nickname other than it being chantable. It has a literal meaning, chief executive officer. But she's not a chief executive officer. It's not the only other option they could have gone with besides boss. They could have kept the same gimmick and just picked another name. I just dislike it so much. But look, at the end of the day, It's only a nickname. It's only a theme song. What stood out most here, and what's most important, is that Mercedes is immediately the biggest star in their women's division by a mile. Not solely because of her name value and because of her time in WWE, but literally her presence in the ring and on the mic. She carries herself like a superstar because guess what? She was a superstar. And she's so much more believable in a top role than the vast majority of women in AEW. Like, look, I get it. They have Paige, Soraya. They have Toni Storm, who was in WWE. But Sasha Banks, Mercedes Moné, is eons bigger than both of them ever were in WWE. It's going to be interesting to see her go face-to-face with the others in this company, especially the bigger women stars, and see the juxtaposition between them when it comes to just presence in the ring. Hopefully Mercedes can elevate this roster. Also interesting is she was already part of an AEW commercial that aired in the first picture-in-picture break on the show. What stood out to me, and look, there were a couple AEW, you know, talents in there, but it was mostly ex-WWE talent with her. It was Jon Moxley, Adam Copeland, and her. Now, obviously, what they're trying to do is say, hey, remember these WWE wrestlers that you liked? They're now in this company. And that's okay. That's appropriate. They're stars. They're people that fans recognize and may lead them to tune into the company. But it was just very apparent when those three were front and center in this commercial where it was like, oh, okay, that's what they're trying to do. So that's the take for the first half of Mercedes' debut. Let's move to the second half, which came after the main event, Willow against Riho. Backstage before the match, Mercedes shook Riho's hand and introduced herself with a smile. There was some strong sequences in this match before Willow pounced Riho outside, only to miss a cannonball ringside. Riho came back with a diving double foot stomp and a dragon suplex on the ring apron, plus another diving stomp inside. Willow eventually escaped a jackknife cover, and unfortunately, she had to delay and regroup, but she had a doctor bomb for the win. Riho got most of the offense, but Willow absorbed it, and she looked strong in the finish. It was a really nice match. After a decently extended celebration, the lights went out. Fans chanted CEO, but clearly, the lights aren't going out for Mercedes. Julia Hart showed up on the ramp. Sky Blue then took out Willow's knee for a two-on-one attack. Fans were still chanting CEO. Mercedes eventually came out. I guess the delay was an outfit change because she was wearing different gear. She punched Sky and hit that new gory bomb-style finisher that she used in New Japan. Willow then raised her arm, and Mercedes posed more to end the show. Funny is that it went so long, the theme actually ended in like the final few seconds of Dynamite and was silent. The only problem with this was the fact that Chris Statlander walked Willow out to start the match. If her best friend and partner was right there backstage, why the hell did she need Mercedes to save her? Why not show her having been attacked backstage or something like that? Even if the entire situation was telegraphed with Mercedes ending the show, it required explanation. Now, I was asking myself that at the end of the show. Credit to AEW, because they did post a video on social media afterward with Stat in the trainer's room selling an attack exactly like that from Julia and Sky. So they closed the plot hole immediately, which is a major sign of progress. I just wish we saw that on television, but sometimes you don't have enough time to do that on television. A bit strange that Mercedes' first interactions are around the TBS title instead of, you know, the main women's championship. Maybe the goal, she's going to elevate that first and then move forward by the end of the year. But again, I just kind of thought I wanted her against Toni Storm. I wanted her against some of the bigger women in the division, not so much like helping Willow from Julia Hart and Sky Blue. But again, if she's there to elevate the entire roster, you can't only elevate the top. You got to elevate the entire thing. By the way, I was around like 3.5 stars for the women's match. I forgot to mention. So all in all, how did this compare to the CM Punk debut? It paled in comparison. It just did. That's just the truth. But Mercedes is there. They signed her. She's apparently been signed for a couple of months, according to, I believe, a report from Fightful. And now she's fully in AEW. What is that going to mean for the women's division going forward? This is very much a believe it when I see it type of situation. It's one thing to sign her. It's another thing to say that the women are going to get more time and they're going to get featured more. But there's a few things that need to happen. Number one, not every week necessarily, but some weeks on Dynamite, they need to get more than one match per show. Number two, the women's matches that are booked, whether it's one or two per show, whether it's Dynamite, Rampage, or Collision, they need to have storyline relevance. And number three, when you are booking matches, you got to use your actual roster. I don't want Queen Aminata and Trisha Dora and Robin Renegade having the single match on Collision. Use your actual talent and book meaningful matches and storylines. That is a sign of progress. That is how you move a division forward beyond the fact that you now have a star as the crown jewel of the division. So we will find out, but again, the proof is in the pudding, and I will believe it when I see it. Continuing on with Dynamite. Samoa Joe defended his AEW title against Wardlow. This came immediately after Mercedes' debut. Joe cut a promo backstage saying Wardlow challenging was the biggest mistake of his career, and he doesn't lose championships in the Garden. Adam Cole then read from a book, cutting a taped promo about Wardlow, talking about how he freed him from his captor, saying he found brotherhood in their undisputed hatred for MJF. It was well-produced, but it was super random having him sit in a big chair, read from a book, and this being his promo before this match. It kind of just came out of nowhere.
Oh, we got two big meaty men bumping me tonight!
In terms of the match, Wardlow impressively hit a corkscrew and later was smart, avoiding Joe's fake out before hitting another high-risk move. He also faked a knee injury to gouge Joe's eyes. Wardlow missed a swanton bomb, but powerbombed Joe off the ropes. Joe caught him with a coquina clutch, jumping on his back with Wardlow inches from the ropes, choking him out for a stoppage title retention. It felt like it should have been a three-arm drop situation, but Wardlow was just nudged, his arm didn't move, and they called the match. Swerve Strickland stormed to the ring, mean mugging. He took out some security with a chain. Joe laughed him off and walked away. Now, this concluded an extremely hot 30 minutes of SmackDown to open the show, again, on the back of Mercedes' debut. It was smart to build the show that way because they get the big bump from Big Bang Theory, and you want to keep as many people tuned in as possible. The match, it largely went as expected.
Big meaty man slapping meat.
And that's what we got to see. I mean, there was a lot of beef out there.
There's a lot of beef out here.
There was beef flying in the ring. I hope they reinforce the ring post.
Reinforce the ring post. The beef's going to be flying tonight, gentlemen.
And Wardlow did get a chance to look strong by delivering the majority of the offense, despite Joe ultimately retaining. That said, it was a real flat finish, especially given how sudden Joe locked in the clutch and how quickly Wardlow passed out. I'd have liked to see him struggle and nearly break the hold before just succumbing to it, especially given all the shit he's been talking the last few weeks coming into the match. And this is a guy cutting fiery, angry promos, and he is out to the coquina clutch in 10 seconds. Suddenly, the badass is just another dude going down super easy at snap of Joe's fingers. As mentioned before, AEW uses the knockout finish far too often to protect its stars, but this was the appropriate usage of it. But because it happens so frequently, you just roll your eyes. You're like, oh, of course, that's how the match ended, because it happens all the time. Beyond that, the result of this basic entire Undisputed Era storyline is Wardlow still looking like a mid-carder. Roderick Strong has the international title. Hadn't been on TV since winning it. More on him later. As far as Swerve, I really hope they put off a rematch here. It seems like either Swerve's going to win the title if they go one-on-one at Dynasty, or maybe that's where Hangman returns, he costs him, and they fight for a fourth or fifth time, I forget. I maintain, as I've been saying for weeks, Will Ospreay needs to be crowned at All In, so it's just going to be interesting to see how they book the AEW title moving forward. Speaking of Ospreay, on Collision, Bryan Danielson beat Shane Taylor in 14 minutes to open the show. The match had no reason for happening, but it was the best of the weekend in AEW, 3.5, 3.75 stars, something like that. Taylor badly bruised Danielson's chest, kicked out of a head kick at one, then hit a big running splash, but Bryan hit the Bazaiku knee for the win. He is now doing the yes hand gestures completely, even though he said he, of course, would not do that in AEW. Ospreay entered after the bell, putting over Danielson, being an inspiration as a top-tier professional wrestler. Bryan responded, saying he would give Will a chance to prove he's the best in the world by going one-on-one with him at Dynasty. Then they shook hands. On one hand, it feels way too soon to go Danielson-Ospreay. It's a legitimate dream match. Maybe the top match for Will in AEW. So doing it right away is like when Roman Reigns and John Cena happened at No Mercy instead of a big four WWE premium live event. On the other hand, since Bryan's full-time run is coming to an end in less than a year, maybe the idea was to make sure this happened with both of these guys 100% healthy as soon as possible. And there's probably other plans for later in the year that would complicate matters. Either way, this should main event Dynasty, no matter what else is booked for the show. It was a fine segment, but I'm really excited for the match. On Dynamite, Ospreay came out for a third in-ring promo in 2 weeks. Fans chanted bruv. Ospreay said he wanted to emulate Bryan's career. He talked about it being worth it to use the Dangerous Tiger Driver 91. He then turned the catchphrase "Restore the Feeling" into "I am the feeling," stating that his match with Danielson would do exactly that. Fiery, passionate, direct. It was just an excellent promo from Ospreay. Literally, my only note is he kept randomly looking to his left while he was speaking into the camera, which was super distracting as a viewer. But look, this is what a star looks like. It's what a star sounds like. It's what a star presents himself as. He's been batting 1,000 since joining AEW. The weird thing is this kind of felt like a go-home promo. So maybe Ospreay's going back to England for a couple of weeks because this match is like 5 or 6 weeks out. I wonder what they're going to do between now and then with so much time left. But this was really exceptional in every possible way from Will. I saw a quote from him this week. I should mention this before we continue, where he said AEW offered him a far better deal than WWE, and it was not a tough choice for him. I don't doubt that one bit. First of all, I'm sure Tony Khan backed up the Brinks truck, as he should have, for Ospreay, way more so than Kazuchika Okada. But second, everyone needs to remember, AEW is letting this guy live in England. That simply does not work in WWE. So more money, less work, and less time in America. Of course it was a better deal for him. Everyone also needs to get it through their heads that WWE was always working from underneath to sign this guy, given the long-term relationships that already exist. It's like when AEW pursued Randy Orton. Sure, they had a shot, they offered him a bunch of money, and they lost because it was never that likely to happen in the first place. The folks who WWE has directly lost to AEW in reality are Jon Moxley, Bryan Danielson, and Adam Copeland, though Copeland said it was a mutual split with WWE. Mercedes, they had the chance to sign her. They turned down her financial ask. Ospreay and Okada were always headed to AEW. And Jay White would have been in WWE if not for the hiring freeze and the return of Vince McMahon. So it's a finite number of people. That doesn't change the fact that signing Ospreay and Okada and Mercedes are huge gets for AEW. But you see all these people online, and I know I've been like berating the IWC over the last couple of weeks, but shit that is being said is just so frustrating both ways. Shit about WWE, shit about AEW. But you see these people, oh, Triple H failed, he can't sign a free agent. It's not accurate. It's not reality. But Ospreay is kicking ass in AEW right now. As I said, upon his debut as a full-timer, I mentioned this with Chris Vanini. We had the whole conversation on the show. This is the guy for them. This is the person you build around, not an aging and injured Kenny Omega, not a Jon Moxley who really only has one gear, not a Bryan Danielson who, despite being immensely popular, is near the end of his career, at least as a full-timer. Will Ospreay is like 30. He's exceptional. He's arguably, and maybe there's not even an argument, the best active professional wrestler in the world when it comes to in-ring competition. This is the guy you build around, and again, this is why you strap him up at All In. Don't waste time. Make him your guy. Put him front and center and put him over in front of his home country. Let's move on. We got a lot more still to discuss. On Rampage, Penta El Zero Miedo beat Action Andretti in another random match. He super kicked him out of thin air and hit Fear Factor for the win. It was the best match on Rampage, I guess, but barely. On Collision, the Elite murdered a trio of jobbers in 2 minutes. This was Kazuchika Okada's first match as a full-timer. He played up the heel work exceptionally well. He just crushed these dudes. And we saw his picture-perfect dropkick counter as well. Eddie Kingston attacked one-on-three like an idiot babyface after the bell. He was immediately beat down by the Young Bucks. So Penta ran out in a Venom mask and got some licks before Okada ended him with a single knee breaker. He again lifted the Continental title. So then Pac returned to AEW. He took out the Bucks. He brawled with Okada, who was eventually saved by the Bucks. Then Pac said that he's looking for trouble, and Kingston challenged them to a trios match. It was strange how the faces came out one by one, but Pac's return was hot. Dude is yoked up. He's huge, and it's an easy storyline for them to create a legitimate match on Dynamite. So we had Kingston, Penta, and Pac against the Elite. Before the match, Okada was asked a question backstage with the Bucks interrupting, saying he had 14 million reasons to do so. Okada said a few words in English and demanded "Happy Birthday" be sung for Matt Jackson. This was one of those like move after move after move matches. Pocket a springboard 450. Kingston took a low blow behind the referee's back, plus a rainmaker from Okada for the heel win. He held up the Continental title again after the belt. Okada directly over Kingston was necessary. You need to build that title match, and that's been expected, obviously, since his debut. It's going to be interesting to see how Rainmaker, the move, is treated in AEW, because in New Japan, it no longer was like a single move finisher, at least not against top caliber opponents. Usually took multiple Rainmakers to put someone down. Sometimes Tombstone Piledrivers in there as well. Maybe they can reestablish it as a one-shot finisher in AEW. That would be a huge positive. The most exciting part of the match for me was Okada briefly interacting with Penta. That should be an awesome match one day. Also, Okada and Pac. That should be a really good match one day too. Other than that, it was largely a spot fest, which, as you know, is not my favorite type of match, but the fans did love it. Turns out Okada is going to fight Kingston next week. But get this, it's only for the Continental Championship, not the contrived Triple Crown. Now, I presume the idea is, I guess, not to have him become a New Japan champion right away again, because the NJPW Strong title is part of it. But if Okada wins, which he must, at least that should be the expectation going in, then suddenly that contrived Triple Crown is broken up, and it's truly just another mid-card title in AEW, the Continental. Or there's a DQ and they rematch, or Okada wins the Continental, and they have to fight again for him to win the other two titles and reestablish the Triple Crown. It is just so odd to do it this way and not even explain why he's only going after one title. The guy should be motivated to win all three of them. On Dynamite, Darby Allin fought Jay White. This was the mid-show feature. Darby was all bandaged up with commentary selling that he's in rough shape. He did a standing swanton bomb outside and took a header over some steel steps. Darby also hit a flip-over stunner, a rough code red, and a nice scorpion death drop. Then he tried a coffin drop onto the apron, where he laid unconscious ringside for 9 seconds before jumping in at 10 and immediately taking Blade Runner, with White getting the W. White extended a hand after the bell, but instead gave the gun salute, and Bang Bang Gang beat him down. He was about to crush Darby's ankle with a chair and bat when Acclaimed ran in to protest and save him. Acclaimed carried Darby out with the guns holding the bottom rope as Billy got in Jay's face and took the bat away, basically trying to talk some sense into him. He turned twice, Billy did, and ate a chair shot from White that imploded the temporary faction with a complete beatdown. Then Darby was brought back inside and took the bat into chair ankle shot to write him off. I went 3.5 stars B for the match. First, let me point out, there was no replay of the coffin drop because it looked awful. Basically, Darby hit the apron with his shoulder and ricocheted onto the floor. Like, he easily could have separated his shoulder, injured his back, something like that. But beyond that, this made no sense from a booking standpoint. My take here is similar to what I said about the gauntlet on WWE Raw this past Monday. Very good for the match, bad for the booking. First, you're writing Darby off because he's climbing Mount Everest. Fine. You do that with White taking advantage of his injuries, beating him down significantly, and getting a clean win with White looking immensely strong coming out of the match. Instead, the booking was for Darby to get like 70, 80% of the offense, and the only reason he lost was because he took a risk that didn't work, and it was happenstance that Jay was there ready to hit Blade Runner. It did absolutely nothing for White to get this win, and he was the one in need of a boost because he's actually sticking around and he's been booked like shit. That's really the travesty of it all. He's been booked terribly. He finally gets put in a match that can raise his profile, and he's made to look like the B-side the entire match, who's lucky to get the win at the end. That is awful booking. And if you were going to do that booking, what you do is you have Darby take the count out. White gets pissed off, drags him inside, beats the ever-loving shit out of him one-on-one, and sure, you get the same result, White winning, and it's kind of happenstance, but at least he's looking really strong. Then you have Acclaimed come out and stop him from beating the shit out of Darby by himself instead of it being a three-on-one situation. Now, I saw some who rolled their eyes about the ankle injury write-off because Darby has already stated publicly multiple times that he was taking a break. I don't mind that at all. The idea can be that White injured the ankle to ensure he fails at his mission to climb Mount Everest, which is a dickish heel move, because it doesn't even have to do with wrestling, that's just personal. I hope that gets stated in a promo. And finally, the breakup, obviously anticipated since the second they formed together. My assumption from the beginning has been that the trio's titles would be unified. It makes zero sense to have two sets of them, even if they're for different brands. So this takes us to the ultimate end. Hopefully, it's Bang Bang Gang that wins and actually builds a division, because Acclaimed is completely worn out. But you guys know, we've been talking about that for months already. On Collision, Nick Wayne beat a jobber in 3 minutes with Wayne's World. A masked man in an AEW sweatshirt attacked Christian Cage over the barricade after the bell. It was Adam Copeland looking like a raccoon because he had tons of black eye makeup. Not that dissimilar, by the way, from what Ronda Rousey used to do. Then he opened up a random box from under the ring and held up the TNT title separately from it. The patriarchy surrounded the ring. Copeland opened the box further. It had Spike written on it, by the way. Christian saw it, immediately backed down, and left his title in the ring with Copeland. Then he screamed Copeland, repeating, I guess, that it would be an I Quit match as he held up this really wide rectangular box. I'm not going to judge this either way until we see what's in the box. I presume it's some type of weapon or vice or something that could lead to Cage feeling immense pain and saying I quit in the title match next week. But holy shit, did Copeland look like an absolute idiot with the makeup? And yes, I'm sure he wore the makeup because he had the mask on. But you barely see his face in the mask. You didn't need to have that. And the fact that he was going to be out of the mask for 10 times longer than he was in it, if you're AEW, you got to be smart enough to say, hey, it's really not worth it to do the eye makeup if no one's even going to see his eyes in the mask. Like, you got to think that shit through. On Rampage, the TBS title was on the line for some reason. Julia Hart successfully defended against Rob and Renegade via submission with Heartless in a 4-minute House Rules match. Why was her first title defense and second match overall in 2 months against a jobber?
You can ask me that 10,000 times, Cole. I'm never going to have an answer for you.
On Collision, House of Black fought Mark Briscoe, Jay Lethal, and Jeff Jarrett in an Atlanta street fight. Jarrett told Briscoe backstage all he needed to trust was that Jarrett would do anything it takes to win. Briscoe said, okay. The House poured gasoline on a table and on Sanjay Dutt atop the stage. Julia taunted him with a lighter, only for Karen Jarrett to come out and low blow Buddy Matthews, who then got pounced by Sanjay off the ramp into a table. So Julia kneed Sanjay in the nuts and misted Karen. Birdie King did the hanging sleeper on Lethal. Then he ate a guitar shot and fell through a table outside. Jarrett took the end. Briscoe blocked the spike shot. He used J Driller on Malachi Black. Black and Matthews then caught him trying a cannonball tope outside, but they had to put him on the ring apron because the table that was supposed to be on fire was not on fire yet. So they set the table on fire. They powerbombed him through it. They helped put out the fire, and then they pinned him 1-2-3. The finish was messy and rushed and convoluted, but I also didn't expect them to let a guy burn, so people criticizing that aspect are being really silly. This is still a performance at the end of the day. You got to make sure the people are safe. The match had a lot of fun spots, but would I have let it main event one of my two major shows? No. This probably should have kicked off the show. But the real takeaway, I mean, let's be clear about this. Buddy's status in AEW right now is being beat up by Sanjay and Karen. That's the definition of saying the grass isn't always greener on the other side. It sure as hell seems like he's on his way out whenever possible, but it was a good time. Probably a B-minus match overall. On Collision, Mariah May beat Trish Adora in 6 minutes. As mentioned last week, Adora is now in the Queen Aminata role where she wrestles a bunch for no reason and jobs. Because heaven forbid, the actual division gets used for the one women's match per show. Mariah did the Tony gimmick and won with Mayday. Storm came out after and gave the Tony with an I award to Mariah, who was the only nominee for her portrayal of Tony's gimmick. Deonna Purrazzo then ran down, stole a shoe, beat Storm with it until May stopped her with a DDT on the ramp. I was really into the whole award shtick. I was kind of like enjoying it. And then Deonna attacked and I'm like, why is this feud still happening? On Dynamite, Purrazzo got a backstage promo saying she would find a partner and fight them in a tag team match next week. She said the shoe was headed straight up Tony's ass. It was okay, but again, I'm wondering why it's still continuing. On Rampage, there was a 20-second video package, maybe shorter, for an ROH tag team called the Infantry. All we really learned was they were in the military at one point. You could have figured that out based on the way they dressed and their name. On Collision, FTR put themselves over, celebrating a decade of working together. They were excited for the forthcoming tournament and repeated the same stuff about being the greatest tag team, putting on great matches, and putting the division on their backs. They said they would give it all in hopes of becoming the first 3-time AEW tag team champions. Once the promo ended, Infantry interrupted with Sean Dean doing a call and response promo. They got a Magic City chant going. That's an ATL strip club, so that was pretty funny. And then they said they were going to give the division a revival. Ooh, WWE reference. The FTR promo was nothing. The big positive was the Infantry was actually introduced 24 hours before they debuted. But imagine having to point out something basic like that as being progress. But it was. We'll see if they stick around after they lose in this tournament. Presumably, this will be a round one match that just happens to randomly get booked after this confrontation. On Collision, Chris Jericho beat Titan in 12 minutes, catching a Hurricanrana and converting it into Walls of Jericho for a submission. Titan was introduced through a Rampage video package, but the match had no reason for happening. Gates of Agony randomly attacked after the bell, with Hook saving. As mentioned last week, Hook is the latest youngster that Jericho is glomming onto. And that led to Jericho and Hook against Gates of Agony on Dynamite. The gimmick, as it has been for a couple weeks, is that Jericho is back to his old Lionheart persona. Tagging completely disintegrated when Hook got the hot tag. Eventually, the faces hit what was supposed to be a combination Red Rum Lion Tamer, but Hook only had half of it in. Jericho broke it to kick the other dude off the ring apron, and Hook kept Red Rum locked in for the win. Jericho later put Hook over for rising to the occasion, but said he wants a friendly fight one-on-one next week to see what he's really got, the idea being that he'll respect Hook after they fight. That was all fine. It's going to be for the FTW title. Really don't have anything else. I'm a big fan of the post-match interview backstage airing on TV instead of exclusively on social media. WWE does that way too often, and the fact that AEW put this on TV was great. They should do that more. Both companies should do that more. I'm not as out on Jericho as everyone else is, but I also don't feel like he's being used right. There's no reason for this to be a team or for him to be in this tournament. He has a role in AEW. He's still a big name, just not doing this. On Rampage, Orange Cassidy and Trent Beretta beat Kip Sabian and The Butcher. This was a nothing match, so Orange and Trent could wrestle ahead of the tournament. It ended with Strong Zero. On Rampage, Top Flight won a triple threat over Private Party and Brian Keith and Commander in the main event. What a random third team. The finish was interesting, but it was slightly botched where it became clear Commander did the entire finishing move himself. The idea here was similarly to boost Top Flight ahead of the tournament. On Dynamite, Kyle O'Reilly backstage wondered whether he could still hang in the most competitive roster in the history of the sport. Not sure about that. His first match back will be on Collision against Brian Keith. Strong and Kingdom then walked in giving him support to make it on his own. So we finally saw Strong for 5 seconds. The most notable part was Kyle was wearing a plain white t-shirt, which made him look so much better than like the dirty camo style stuff he wore over his first two appearances. On Collision, Mystico beat Angelico in 10 minutes. This was a real match on television. One guy from CMML and another guy who was never on AEW TV. So Mystico won via submission with an armbar, and commentary put him over for being 4-0 in AEW. So they might be building to a title match or something for Forbidden Door. He's only 3-0 in singles, and none of those people were anyone of note. And lastly, on Rampage, Ruby Soho backstage was upset, forcing tears, saying Angelo Parker was hurt and may have torn some ligaments after the attack last week. You'll remember he was hit twice with a blackjack, so I'm not sure how he would tear ligaments. Ruby got angry, telling Saraya that she hates her and that she's ugly. She also called her family inbred. Saraya later yelled at Ruby through the camera, saying it's all her fault. Then she smacked someone's solo cup. That went into her brother. He grabs this dude, pushes him against the wall, screams at him, and then hits him in the throat. Typically good Ruby delivery, really strange content. Typically terrible Saraya segment.
It's got about as much chance of getting over as Orange Cassidy.
I hate this. I hate this crap. Stop. Stop with the crap.
Now, we did have a listener, Brendan in Boston, appropriate Twitter handle, at Brendan in Boston, who was at the show. He sent us paragraphs and paragraphs of notes via DM, and we appreciate that. I'm not trying to give you a hard time here, but he sent us a lot, and I don't have time to read it all in the show, but here are some Cliff's notes from his extensive notes from the show. He said the crowd was much older than a WWE crowd, very few kids, that AEW does not do much during its commercial breaks, that Darby's selling was really strong in his match, that Jericho was the least over guy in his match. He said the women were super over with the crowd, pretty much all of them. And he also said the one-off Mercedes t-shirts that they made for the event sold out fast, and he put over a really strong Boston crowd. And that's a good point, Brendan, because I did not really get a chance to mention that on the show. Boston did its job for not just Mercedes Moné, but the entire Dynamite on Wednesday. We generally don't go over like whether an AEW crowd is good or bad, because usually they're really loud, even in small numbers, like the 2,000, 3,000 seaters that they've been doing recently. And that has been their attendance for most Dynamites and Collisions as of late. They've still been pretty loud, not necessarily, you know, chanting 9,000 people CEO type of loud, but loud nonetheless. So generally, AEW crowds don't need to get evaluated the same way that some WWE crowds do. But despite all of that, Boston was strong on Wednesday night. Now, as mentioned with the NXT ratings situation, generally, we just don't talk about ratings here on the show. But it is absolutely notable what AEW Dynamite did for the debut of Mercedes Moné and a special big business episode that also had an AEW title match and some other big matches set for the show. And the numbers came in as we were taping the podcast. We got to it late on Thursday. AEW did 801,000 viewers, which is up, and a 0.27 demo, which is down. They were third for the night on television. Now that's down 51,000 viewers with the exact same demo as last year, and up 22,000 viewers and the exact same demo as last week. So to answer the very simple question, is Mercedes Moné a significant draw for AEW? On first blush, you know, the answer is no. She didn't make a significant difference in the show, at least not the same way. And we could have predicted this, obviously, but not the same way that CM Punk did when he made his debut on Collision a couple years ago. But this is another person in the line of folks who has either debuted or showed up on AEW TV, promoted or not promoted, alluded to or not alluded to, that don't really seem to move the needle. We talked about it with Kazuchika Okada. We talked about it with Will Ospreay. We talked about it with Adam Copeland, and now with Mercedes Moné. Now, that's not to say that Mercedes being part of AEW may not help them become more consistent in the ratings week to week, or if there's a big match booked for her, a title match in the main event, that maybe it could really increase the ratings on a given show. But the fact that you're talking about pretty much the exact same ratings from a week ago, when Okada made his debut unadvertised and still down significantly from a few weeks ago when AEW was in, I think, the high 800s. I mean, that is problematic. And then when you look at the demo number, 0.27, I mean, AEW was firmly in the threes for a good period of time. So it's just interesting to kind of look at that number with Mercedes' debut. It's not end of the world. There's still, you know, plenty of opportunity for her with AEW. She's going to do a lot of great things. She's a fantastic wrestler. Really, all she needs to do is stay healthy, and she will help elevate that women's division. And we'll see whether the revolution is actually going to happen. But in terms of elevating the division, I'm quite sure it will. But again, just discussing the ratings on a one-off right here at the end of the show, yeah, they certainly cannot be happy with those numbers. So folks, let's go ahead and wrap up this edition of the Getting Over Wrestling podcast. Allow me to remind you that this show
is all about Defy.
So head on over to Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Leave those 5-star ratings. On Apple, take a little extra time. Leave a 5-star written review. If you do, we will read it live right here on the show. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Getting Overcast for episode drops, news, analysis, highlights, all of that good stuff. It is also where you can send us DMs and tweets, questions and comments for the show that, of course, we will do our best to read live on the air. Please also remember,
I happen to love the number 5.
And I hope you do as well, because for $5 a month or $50 for the entire year, you can become an official Getting Overhead. Just visit buymeacoffee.com/gettingover. Sign up. You will get bonus audio, the fastest 5 minutes in professional wrestling, instant reaction shows to Raw, NXT, Dynamite, and SmackDown every week, along with exclusive news posts every single Friday. Again, buymeacoffee.com/gettingover. In terms of what's to come here on the show, we will be back on Tuesday with our next WWE episode. 1 week from now, same bat time, same bat channel. On Thursday, your next NXT and AEW show. We have some interesting irons in the fire in terms of interviews for WrestleMania 40. Keep your ears peeled and eyes open for those. And folks, that is pretty much all I got for you today. So the Silver King is going to wrap up this edition of the Getting Over Wrestling podcast. The Silver King is signing off and leaving you with just 3 final words. Bye for now.